What great music! Like, what can you say? Actually, I'm not the encore to the music. They should be here to do an encore, but we're so blessed. It's great to be back again. Al, who was with you the last 2 weeks, expresses his appreciation to each and every one of you for being such a great participants in his presentation. So the way we've done it so far, this is the book we're talking about, God and Randomness. How many of you have not been here yet? This is your first time. Okay. We have gone through the first 5 chapters of this book. Those deal with sort of a definition of what randomness is, and then Al's 3 stories from his family, and then he engaged us in a discussion of the random events, as they're called, that were associated with the Big Bang and the evolution of the universe, our solar system, and the emergence of human life on our planet, and especially the emergence of self-consciousness. So I'm going to give this to my wife, Sally, to hold on to this. We'll proceed now, as Michelle said, with the humanities side. Al once said that he works with the hard sciences, and I'm the touchy-feely guy, is the way I'm defined. But then there was someone who told me that he works with the hard sciences, but I work with the harder humanities. So, in fact, I think that was that Frank who told me that. So give Frank credit for that line. I like to use it, but I don't take credit for it. He's the one who did it. But anyway, let's talk a little bit about the 20th century. We're jumping now into the 20th century for a couple of reasons, and it's a century that's probably been studied more than any other. And many of us who were actually born in that century, myself included, have memories of some of the very important events that occurred in that century. We are now in the second decade of the 21st century, and much of what happens here in our own time as we speak is directly related to the events of the 20th century. So I'm going to try to demonstrate today how randomness is associated with what happened during that 100 years. Now, I've started out here with the words, just imagine. If you look at the overhead, you're living in the year 1900. Could you have predicted 5 of the major 20th century events? Think of yourself. The first one is the First World War, and here are some of the random events associated with this, because in the latter part of the 19th century, it was sometimes called the time of optimism. And it was assumed that once the 20th century emerged, it would be all wonderful and glorious and color me happy and so on and so forth. As we know, that turned out, in fact, not to be the case. And the first major event, of course, is World War I. And the most important random event that we do remember involves the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife, Sophia, who were the heirs of the Austria-Hungarian throne. And at that time, there was some emerging animosity among the European nations. And then this Sarajevo ethnic Serb assassinated the Archduke and his wife. And that was the trigger that started the unexpected event, the random event that started the First World War. Because once the Archduke was assassinated, and he and his wife, there was no heir to the throne, and nations began coalescing in the various alliances, and that triggered what we know of as the First Great War. Unexpected, but it happened, and it also dampened the excessive enthusiasm that many people had at the transition of that century. So that's the first event, wasn't expected. Then all of a sudden, in May 17th, 1915, by the way, the war starts in 1914, the ship called the Lusitania, or some people say Tania, I've heard it both ways, was sunk by the German U-boats, and a great number of passengers were killed. It is not a warship. It is a passenger ship. How many of you have been on a cruise before? That's the kind of boat it was. It was a cruise boat, and the U-boat sank it, and 128 Americans who were sailing on that ship. That was completely unexpected. Can you hear me? It had to, yes, but it was carrying weapons as well, but it was a cruise ship primarily. I'll get back to that issue. Let's save that for later, because what you're pointing to is something very important. What seems like a random event is a mixture sometimes of various characteristics that cause some people to respond in that situation and other people not to respond. So your comment is very, very good. In fact, all of the ships that were in the English Channel had to protect themselves. And so the Germans used that as an excuse to sink anything that was out there. That's a very good observation, though. And Woodrow Wilson, who was president at the time, and the U.S. public were just simply outraged. And one can imagine this to be the case. And as you know, when the First World War began, what we now call the First Great War, some people just say it's the first phase of two wars, which really should be connected together, the American public was neutral. Let the Europeans fight their own war. We want nothing to do with this. That was the general perception, until what happened is Kaiser Wilhelm II, who was in charge of that, instructed the Mexican ambassador to form a German-Mexican alliance against the United States. Most people don't know that this is a little factoid of history, but it is the straw that broke the camel's back for United States neutrality. And when that happened, as they say, Wilson went to war. It was 1917. So the U.S. was out of the First World War until 1917, and then felt compelled to go in it. And then 2 years later, after the U.S. joined the war, it was all over. That was it. So think of the random events that finally even pushed the United States into that First World War. And Wilson, who was a pacifist when he came in the presidency, is the one who led then the congressional action that resulted in the United States going to war. Now, shortly after the war, the Treaty of Versailles was signed on June 28, 1919, exactly to the day that Franz Ferdinand and his wife were assassinated. 5 years exactly to the day. And little did anybody know that this treaty would sow the seeds of Nazism. But it was to the Treaty of Versailles that Hitler used and turned to exploit, that's how it worked in his head, to exploit the animosities that he wanted the German people to feel against the Europeans and the French and the British and the Americans and everybody who engaged in that treaty, which basically stripped the German people of their entire dignity. It's a very important event, and it laid all of the blame for the First World War on the shoulders of which nation? We know what it is. It was Germany. So Germany felt totally humiliated, and Hitler used that humiliation for the next great war. Now, that's the first great event. The second great event is the Great Depression and the New Deal. Known as Black Tuesday or Black Thursday, the stock market crashed in late October 1929. Now, why is it called Black Tuesday or Black Thursday? Well, you know, Black Tuesday is when the stocks first took a tumble. 2 days later, they were lower than they'd ever been. That's why it's called Black Thursday. So Black Tuesday and Black Thursday do go together, and the results were catastrophic for the U.S. and Europe. In the United States alone, unemployment rose to 25%. Now put yourself in the middle of 1920s, 1926, 1924. What did we call America during that time? The progressive era, but what was the mood of the country? Very bouncy and optimistic. It was the era of the flapper. Right? The era of dancing, the era of joy, the era of all kinds of returned optimism. Until Black Thursday and Black Tuesday. And then the stock market fell. So let's see what happens here. Here's the Great Depression. The results. Wages fell 42% for those who were still working. Or 25% were out of work. Hundreds of banks closed and thousands lost their life savings in those banks. The stock market value tumbled 89%. So if you own stock at the beginning of October 1929, by the mid-1930s, your stocks weren't worth very much. They had taken such a tumble. Soup kitchens were common, And one of my favorite songs from that era is Buddy, Can You Spare a Dime? In fact, I used to sing with the string quartet, and we sang that song. And I actually had somebody once from the audience come up and give us a dime. That actually did happen. I said, no, it's just a song. It's okay. I said, but that's okay. And we politely took the dime and enjoyed. Not that you could do much with it, but we did enjoy it anyway. Also, the Dust Bowl happened to occur about that time, and that affected folks here in Texas and especially in Oklahoma and across the South. Completely unexpected event. It was the Great Drought, if you want to think of it that way, of the 1930s, and hundreds of farmers lost their farms. And if you know the great book, The Grapes of Wrath, I don't know if you've seen the movie, it's one of the great movies of that time that depicts, in this particular case, the Joad family and the travails that it experienced as it was trying to cope with the Dust Bowl problems that occurred for all the farmers. And of course, we know that very familiar face. That is the father of Jane Fonda, who is, of course, Henry Fonda. And he played the Tom Jones character. And there's that great line at the end, wherever there's injustice, I'll be there. Wherever there are troubles, I'll be there. I mean, it's a wonderful line. And John Steinbeck, who wrote the book, got a Pulitzer Prize for that book. That's how good it is and turned into a movie. And it is now considered one of the classics. If you make a list of 100 great movies, The Grapes of Wrath is always on it. And it reminds us of this unexpected second great event that occurred during the 20th century. But Americans did not throw down the towel and shout uncle. There was one politician by the name of Franklin Delano Roosevelt who was elected to public office in 1932. Who'd have thunk it, but he was. And he came in, and during the course of his time as the president, he began 50 new programs to stimulate economic growth. And many of these programs are still in effect today, and you will recognize them. First of all, of course, is Social Security. And I suspect there are, like myself, individuals in this room who are still benefiting from Social Security. And every once a month, you look forward to that, oh yeah, U.S. government coming into you, either by mail or electronically. FICA, which is the what? Federal Insurance Corporation of America. What does it protect? Your bank savings. Up to how much money should your bank close? Will the government protect you? $250,000. So if you have $249,000, you're safe. If you have $251,000, you lose $1,000 if the bank closes. But that's still in effect. And that was FDR's program. And the reason he passed it is because so many people, or actually the Congress passed it, with his support and approval and signature. And the reason being that so many people had lost their savings when the banks closed, that this was the federal government's way of responding. Fannie Mae mortgages, might even be people in here who've used Fannie Mae to mortgage a house. National Labor Relations Board, which still mediates disputes that occur between management and labor. The SEC, which is the Security and Exchange Commission. Also, the federal government sets interest rates and so on. The TVA, which is the Tennessee Valley Authority, which again is one of the programs. There are others that are no longer in existence. The CCC, which was the Conservation Corps. Many of you who've gone out to some of our national or state parks and you love those wonderful old cabins that are out there, they were built by the CCC program. The PWA, which is the Public Works Administration, no longer exists. National Youth Administration, etc. I mean, the list goes on and on during that era. And of course, it was the result of having been elected to four times as the presidency, even though Roosevelt died in his fourth presidency, that amendment of the Constitution was passed, which nobody expected, that says you can only serve how many years? Two terms or 10 years. That's the direct result. You can serve two more years if you come in as Truman did, for example, after Roosevelt passed away, you could serve two and then you could follow up. The same was also true of LBJ, although he was 3 years, I believe, or 2 years, and then he finally decided not to run in 1968. But here was Roosevelt's main contribution, which was totally unexpected in 1932, and that is he changed the role of government in American society. Now, the place here is not to debate whether that's good or bad, other than to recognize that he did. And he was the one who said, you know, the federal government can employ people, and employ people through all of these federal programs he developed. And when people have money, what do they do with it? They spend it. And when they spend it, they stimulate demand for goods and services in the marketplace. And when the economy is robust through the demand side, what happens to the supply? It increases because businesses respond to the demand by creating more jobs for people. That's the idea behind the stimulus to get the economy going. And there is a pretty much, we've discussed this in our book, a pretty ample indication that the economy was beginning to rebound under Roosevelt toward the end. But then, of course, the World War II came along as well. Think of the entire era of the Great Depression, and from 1932 until 9 or so years later, when what actually begins to happen is the American economy turns around. And in 1932, people are like, or 1929, especially when the stock market crashes, like, what is going on here? Can we survive? And nobody really knew whether we could or not. And as it turned out, we did, and came back stronger as a result of it. The third great event is the Second World War. This is a story of widespread randomness. Adolf Hitler, one of the history's most vicious tyrants, as we know very well, and after becoming the German chancellor in 1933, he pursued a goal of world conquest that ultimately ended in total disaster in 1945. Think of the short period of time. He invaded Poland in 1939, and between those 6 years, between 39 and 45, over 60, count them, million people lost their lives. More people lost their lives in that six-year period of human history than ever. Could anybody have predicted in 1933, when he became Chancellor of Germany, that 12 years later in 1945, there would be 60 million fewer people on the face of this earth? Not at all. World War II surprises, the invasion of Poland, after Peace in Our Time, remember? Neville Chamberlain, you've seen those films possibly. Pearl Harbor, the siege of Leningrad, Normandy, two atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I suggest the growth of military technology as very, very critical. I don't know if any of you are students of military history. I very much like to read military history and talk about the 15 greatest battles in the history of the earth. They changed the way we do life in our society. Think of our own Civil War, where 600,000 Americans lost their lives, changed America permanently after that war in many, many regards. I've got Hirohito here on the left of Adolf Hitler on, as you look at the slides. The Potsdam Conference was the summer of 1945, and the Allies hammered out an agreement on how to treat Germany. That included dividing Berlin into four separate zones, and this laid the foundation for the fourth major 20th century event. What's it called? The Cold War, all right? And I just put up some photographic summaries of some of the most significant events. On the lower left-hand corner is what? Pearl Harbor. Next to it is what? Concentration camps. Remember after the war? And the concentration camps were opened up, and people said, how could this possibly have happened? That one person in history planned the extermination and the genocide of one entire group of people we know of as Jewish people, out of which our own Christian faith emerged. And plus another 6 million who were killed, and of course to the right of that is the bomb, and to the right of that is probably the best known symbol of the Second World War, which is planting the flag where? Iwo Jima. Everybody knows it. You know who took the photograph? That's a lesser known fact. come back next week. That's your lesson for the week. No, it's Joel Rosenthal who did it. Very, very famous pictures. Actually, Pose, the original one he did was different. But this one, he said, come back, I want you to plant the flag. Hold it right there, click, and he got it. We now have it. It is terrific. It's great stuff. Now, the Cold War. Like World War I, the Depression, World War II, the Cold War has many, many random events. And here's the first one. Stalin's speech in February of 1946 when he declared communism and capitalism to be incompatible. In 1961, the Berlin Wall, lower right-hand corner, was built. Nobody expected it. Why? Because people were fleeing East Germany to go to West Germany and to the West because the economy had become very robust and was on the rebound, whereas the economy in East Germany was receding and getting worse and going into depression, and there was oppression politically as well, and the freedoms that people enjoyed in the West served like a magnet to pull East Berliners toward the West. And what happened? Let's put up a wall and keep them from migrating. It is probably the most recognized symbol of communism's failure during the entire Cold War. And then the Cuban Missile Crisis happens at the same time. So the lower left is an arm wrestling between whom? Kennedy and Khrushchev, yeah. And behind, and next to it is Uncle Sam with his arms around Cuba, which is symbolic of the great embargo that the U.S. put on. And we all know how it ended, and Kennedy made a truce with Khrushchev, and Kennedy agreed to pull nukes out of Poland if Khrushchev would not plant nukes in Cuba. Most people don't know that that was the deal, that Kennedy had to give up something in order to have the nuclear bombs not planted in Cuba. Also, we need to talk about Truman's containment policy, which was very important during the Cold War because it stopped the spread of communism. And while we talk about the Cold War, there were actually two hot wars during that period. The first hot war we know of is Korea, 1950 to 1953. The results, Korea remains divided and is one of our 21st century dilemmas. Anyone who follows the news knows what's going on with regard to nuclear expansion in that North Korean country and what the United States, through our own president and our own publicly elected officials, are trying to do to prevent the worst possible scenario. And then there was Vietnam, Dien Bien Phu, which was when the French were defeated by the North Koreans in 1954, and the Americans took the war over. You know, 19 years later, 58,000 Americans were no longer alive as a direct result of that war. And finally, Nixon withdrew in 1973, but the war did not end till 75 when the North finally conquered the South and united both North and South Vietnam, which is now one country where Americans visit all the time. We now have trade agreements with North, with Vietnam. So this is where, same with Japan. Think of Japan as the enemy and Germany the enemy in the Second World War. Think of the Marshall Plan, unexpected. And now both Japan and Germany, as well as all of Europe, in some very real sense, are now our partners in the world as it continues to change. And when you think that Japan was almost totally, completely destroyed, to be able to rebound the way Japan has is quite a remarkable accomplishment and says a lot about the Japanese people. And of course, the alliance through MacArthur, who was in charge of what's called the political theater, made with the Japanese after the war, which enabled, in fact, Japan to rebound and become a very close ally of ours. Unexpected, but it happened. Was a surprise to everybody. The biggest surprise of all, however, was the collapse of the Soviet Union, which our own Pentagon did not even see coming. So what happens in 1990 is the Warsaw Pact dissolved, and to everybody's surprise, the Supreme Court, what it's called in the Soviet Union in that year, claimed that the Soviet Union as a distinct nation state ceased to exist. It went out of existence. And that was to everybody's surprise, including our top military officials in what we call the Pentagon. Now, the last one I'm going to take about 3 or 4 minutes, and then I'm going to open it up for comments and questions, is, of course, the rise of terrorism, Islamic Jihad, and the caliphate. Now, what are the unexpected occurrences? We did something on this in here, I think, a year or so ago, right? And we all know about Al-Wahhab, who started the ultra-conservative Salafism movement in Saudi Arabia in the mid-1800s. So that conservatism, really, really conservative Islam, had been percolating in the Middle East for some time, but the really critical events start in B, 5B, and that's the defeat of the Ottoman Caliphate in World War I. That was the end of the Muslim caliphate that had existed up until that time, that started in the year, let's say, 632, when Muhammad died, and then Islam, as you know, expanded throughout the Middle East, across Northern Africa, and so on. And that was then over. The caliphate was gone, even after it divided into three separate sections, or if you think of it as regions, in the year 1258. The defeat of the Ottoman caliphate was a disaster for the radical Muslims. And Ataturk, who is the lower right-hand picture there, started the modern state of Israel, modern state of Turkey. And when he did, he declared the caliphate dead. Well, the radical Muslims didn't stop there, because a man by the name of Albana, and later Gutba, formed what is called the Muslim Brotherhood. And this began in Egypt only 4 years after the creation of 1924, the modern state of Turkey. And the whole goal of this Muslim Brotherhood was to reestablish the caliphate, to make it at the center of the world and to dominate the world as it once did for 500 years, from the year 750 to the year 1258. The Soviet Union is another event here that's very important. Invasion of Afghanistan, 1979, 1989. Who lost that? The Soviets. The Soviets left after 10 years. They could not defeat the Afghanistan. And the United States pumped a lot of missiles in there and all sorts of other things to defeat the Soviets, thinking that the Afghani warriors, Mujahideen, were our friends, which they were at the time, but they forgot there was somebody else who was working with them by the name of Osama bin Laden. And that particular war created Osama bin Laden and led to the establishment of Al-Qaeda. So 9/11 and after, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, and the jihad movement expanded under al-Zarqawi, who is the lower right-hand picture here. And he was killed in 2010 and was replaced by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, whose name is well known in our time because he created the Islamic State Caliphate in 2014. Events rolled very, very quickly and very unexpectedly between 2003 and 2014. 11 years after the U.S. invaded Iraq, there was a caliphate that covered both Syria and Iraq. The IS Caliphate, Islamic State Caliphate, and world reaction. After Baghdadi established the two caliphate capitals in Mosul, in Iraq, in Raqqa, in Syria, both the Islamic and the non-Islamic nations united against him. And this coalition has eliminated the caliphate and Baghdadi. So we think. We're not sure about Baghdadi. He might be still hiding somewhere. We know he was severely injured in a bombing raid through a drone, but we don't know if he's still alive. If so, he's in hiding. But the caliphate, which requires property, territory, in order to survive, is basically gone except for a few cities in Iraq, small towns in Iraq. However, despite the loss of territory, the radical jihad movement persists in several nations, including Somalia, Nigeria, the Philippines, and about four or five others, Libya and so on. And there are active opposition, there is active opposition against them in those countries. However, at this point, the long-term future of this particular thrust within the Islamic community has yet to be decided. And what our role will be, that is the non-Islamic militant role will be, remains yet to be worked out. Finally, I'm going to draw a quick conclusion here, and then we'll open it up for some discussion. To reiterate, it is highly unlikely that anyone living in 1900 could have predicted World War I, the Great Depression, World War II, the Cold War, and the rise of jihadi caliphate. To this list, we could add many other unexpected occurrences, which some people actually think is more important than all of them. And that's the invention of the computer. How many in here do not own an iPhone? 1, 2, 3, 4, some. How many own an iPhone? Oh my! Steve Jobs changed the world. He did. And so did that other person who is back here. Oh, no, that's on my slides for next week. Okay, but think of how that's changed the world. Instant communication anywhere if somebody's got one and you can get a hold of them. Think back when humanity first began 200,000 years ago. The only form of communication we had was face-to-face. We were limited by time and space. Couldn't do it. We had to walk anywhere we wanted to go. Now we fly in jet transportation. And now we can communicate with anybody, anywhere in the world, either through the computer, the iPhone, or iPads, or Kindles, or tweets. When will it stop? You know, this sort of, you know when it'll stop? Never. It'll keep going. It'll keep going because the competition that's out there for people to get a bigger share of that market is going to continue to stimulate innovation. That's the nature of the marketplace. It is an innovation-producing economic system. And don't blink your eyes, because there may be something new out there tomorrow that we'll just what? Have to have. Does anybody in here still own a Smith Corona typewriter? There's one. Al Brunsting told me he just got rid of his last year. He just couldn't keep looking at it anymore. The reason being is his whole study was filling up with electronics and had no place left over for a Smith Corona. It's gone. It's gone forever. This is the way in which it works. And of course, the two pictures up here depict the people who learn it so fast. Young people, right? Both on the they're working it. Yeah, those kids are now too old. They're behind. Yeah, that's exactly right. Now, so the question becomes, what's next? This is always the question. Will we be able to foresee what's coming in the future better than we did in the past? Well, come next week, because we're going to address that question. No, seriously. The session for next week is called The Future. And we're going to take a look. Could we have, if we had the tools of the modern futures movement today, could we have predicted the coming of Pearl Harbor? Could we have predicted 9/11 and prevented it? Can we now look further into the future with the tools of modern foresight that give us a clear image of what might be out there ahead of us? And if it looks foreboding, can we prevent it? Now, finally, after next week, there's 1 week left, and we're going to raise the question. We have seen from beginning to end all of the random events, from the Big Bang right to the 20th century, into the future. We're going to talk about fairness, and then we're going to ask this question. Where does God fit into this picture? How does God relate to randomness? That's what we're going to do 2 weeks from today. And well, if you bought the book and read ahead, you know what the answer is. But if you haven't, we will try to get our head around that question. But before we do that, we're going to talk next week about the future, and are we getting any better at being able to foresee what's ahead than we did in the past? Questions? Yes, sir. Richard. Yes, right. The answer is, let me say yes, 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 and yes. Now, what do I mean? Who could have seen in, let's say, the year 1810, the coming of a civil war that would destroy in the 1860s the institution of slavery? Who could have thought in the year 1920 there would be a 19th Amendment that gave women the right to vote? Who could, that's the second yes. Who would have thunk it back in the beginning of the 20th century even that women 19 years later would be, now there were some suffragettes who believed that would happen, but it took a political momentum to do it. In 1990, there was another act called the ADA, which is the American Disability Act. Who would have thought in the year 1970 that people with disabilities would demand access to buildings that they never had before? And who would have thought that the Supreme Court, that's the third yes, and the fourth yes is right on your issue. Who would have thought that the Supreme Court would say, you can do what? Marry whomever you fall in love with, whatever the gender or sex of that person is. Now, that's still very controversial in our society, and not everybody agrees with that, but you think about how American society has opened up for people who were historically excluded. African Americans, you could even say Hispanic Americans, you could say women get more and more rights, and then you could say disability folks have more rights, and now gay people have more rights, and so on. America is a society that's opened itself up, and who would have thought in the year 1776, when an African American slave was counted as 3/5 of a person, so Southerners who owned black slaves could have more votes in the Constitutional Congress. Who would have thought any of this? Now, are these random? If it's unexpected, which is our definition of randomness, or unpredictable, the answer is yes. So, put yourself now in the year 2000. Can you predict what's going to happen by the year 2099? It's a long way off. We've already had one great surprise in the new president. Who would have thunk this? But it happened. And so now we're living with that administration. Did I see a hand over here? I used to boy, girl, boy, girl. Can you, oh, you're third. You're second. Boy, girl. Your question. The comment, she said, we are not just using the intellect per se, but we now have more meditative, emotional ways and intuitive ways of thinking about what might lie ahead. I'm going to try to deal with that issue. How do we think about the future next week? So rather than take it up now, it's a great comment, though. How do we access what we don't yet know? The one thing about the future is very important. It's not here yet. It's not here yet. The future doesn't exist yet. Where does it exist? Here. It exists inside our head, in anticipating what we think might happen. But guess what? What we think might happen might what? Not happen. Or what we think might not happen might happen. Happens over and over and over again. How do we deal with those kinds of issues? And we're going to try to address that next week. Okay?
Yeah,
good. Yes, sir. No, Jesus did not live in a culture of individual rights. He did not. He lived in a Jewish culture that was dominated by a priestly caste, class. That was Jesus' milieu. And he lived in a country that was occupied by Rome.
But his message is what you're talking about.
But his message was not one of individual rights. The idea of individual rights is an idea from the Enlightenment of the 18th century. It's only a couple hundred years old. But individual rights is something very different, especially written into a constitution where you were protected against somebody who accused you of a wrongdoing. Jesus had no protections, no writ of habeas corpus. He was just simply arrested, taken to trial, and executed summarily by Pilate. There was no protections in that culture. And what Pilate dictated and the Sanhedrin, which was the controlling Jewish group, pretty much determined what would happen to people. And if somebody stuck their head up, so to speak, and even was perceived as a rebel during that time, Pilate would take them out. And Pilate systematically executed anybody who had a reputation for, whether it's true or not, of being a rebel. And the Zealots tried to rebel in the year 66 against the Roman authority, and 4 years later they crushed the rebellion, destroyed the Second Temple, dispersed all the Christians and Jews out of Palestine into Europe. There was no individual rights in Jesus' ideas. That doesn't mean he didn't advocate love and care and concern for the poor, which was one of the core ideas. But the idea of political individual rights is a relatively recent phenomenon in world history. Yes, ma'am. I will deal with that next week, too. The question was, we've been doing lots of predicting for a long, long time, and the example that was used was the environment. And there are people who are predicting what's going to happen to the environment, and the issue is not the prediction, but the point being made, it's the human response to a prediction. And what do you do when there are multiple predictions that are out there regarding any particular event? Which one do you embrace? And I will deal with that, because most of the significant issues that are before us have multiple possible futures, not just one, but multiple possible futures. And the question becomes, why would you choose one and not the other? My goodness, we're already talking about next week here. This is good. This is a wonderful observation. And those are issues that we're all going to take up next week. Yes, sir?
So have you run all this by Siri?
Next question. No, but I think that's a good comment to end with. Besides, someone's bailing me out with the piano back here. So we'll go ahead. Thank you all very much. I hope to see you again next week. Okay.